Israel?
Yeah, we're going to be taking up that part of the Haggadah, which most people are familiar with. The famous paragraph about the four sons. It says, Baruch Hamakom, Baruch Hu. Blessed is God, blessed is He. Baruch Shenasan Torah Le'Am Yisrael. Blessed is He who gave the Torah to His nation Israel. Baruch Hu, blessed is He. Keneged Arba Banim Dibra Torah. The Torah spoke with regard, corresponding to four sons. Echad Chacham, one is a Chacham, one is the wise son. The Echad Rasha, one is the wicked son. The Echad Tam, one is the simple. General translation would seem to be simple, not a Chacham. He's lacking in the attribute of being a Chacham. The Echad She'enu Yedei Lishol, and one who literally does not know how to ask, which would seem to be strange. If he doesn't know how to ask, what does that mean? Why doesn't he know how to ask? Well, we'll see. The first question, of course, is, aside from what is the whole idea, what is the point of learning about four sons? What does that have to do with the Agora? That's the general question. But in terms of the text, why does this begin with the Baruch HaMakom? And then it says, Baruch Shenasan Torah, Le'Am Yisrael. This is a double blessing. One we're just blessing God, per se. And the other one is that for giving the Torah. So the question is, what is the relationship between that and what follows? Keneged Arba Banim. The theme is the four sons. It then proceeds to explain each of the four sons. How do you detect, how do you determine what category he's in, and how you respond to him? What's the purpose of this whole idea of the four sons? Why are we learning about this? Why is the Haggadah going into this at all? The Rambam in Hilchos Chametz Umatzah, Perek Shavi, that's 7, Halacha Aleph, that's 1, first Halacha, Mitzvah Saseh Shel Torah. It is a positive command of the Torah. L'saper b'nisim v'niflos, to discuss, to tell the story of, the miracles and wondrous things Shenasu lavoseinu b'mitzrayim, that were done to our fathers in Egypt. B'leil chamisha asar b'nisan, on the night of the 15th of Nisan. Shenema zochar asayom azeh, asher yitzasam b'mitzrayim, because it says, remember this day that you left Egypt. K'mo shenema zochar asayom ha-shabbos, in the same way that it says, Zachar Es Yom HaShabbos. Which means that just like Zachar, when it says remember the day of the Shabbos, it's not talking about remembering something that you might have forgotten. It's an enunciation. It's referring to an enunciation of the Kiddush Hayom. From there we derive the mitzvah of Kiddush, the sanctification of the day, which has to do with declaring what it is that makes it holy. That thus, the term Zachar, when applied over here, is referring to the mitzvah of Sibur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Then he says, "Minayin shebaleil chamisha asar." How do we know that it's on the night of the 15th? Talmud Lomar, "Vigar telavincha, b'yom ahu lemor, b'avurzeh, b'shoa sheyesh matzu mar menachem fenecha." How do we know that it's on the 15th? He quotes another pasuk, which says, you shall tell it to your son on that day, saying, because of this, means to say that he's referring to something specific. When he says, because of this, did God take me out of Egypt, What's the this that he's referring to? Referring to the objects of the evening. Because of this is the mitzvahs, halayla. The things that we do because of the mitzvahs, which is matzah, which is mara, and we do that in the course of the Seder. We point out to each object, and we explain the significance of that object. Now the idea that the sipur has to take place not purely in an abstract manner. It's not just an abstract phenomenon. When people get together and just discuss ideas, it takes place in conjunction with the actual mitzvos that pertain. So you're fulfilling sipur, you're fulfilling the mitzvah of recitation of the story through discussion, but also through certain activities which express the ideas. That's mitzvos. The mitzvos of that night. And that's what the pasuk is telling you. Bavur zeh means that because of this, because of these objects, that's part of the sipur, that's part of the discussion, means to say that those objects must be in front of you at that time. That is, you cannot tell the story when you don't have the objects of matzah, of maror, of the carbon pesach, where we don't have the Passover sacrifice today, we have the substitute, that's the zecher. But when you had it, you'd have the mitzvah of discussion of the story has to be done in that context. What do we deduce from this? We deduce the night of the 15th. We know that these mitzvahs are to be performed on that night. The time for the mitzvah of matzah is the 15th. The time for maror is the 15th. And Pesach. All these mitzvahs take place on the night of the 15th. And it says that you shall tell it to your child on that day, saying, because of this. This is a reference to the objects that are utilized in the mitzvah. That's connecting the mitzvah of the sipur, of telling the story, juxtaposing that to the actual mitzvahs that you perform on that. Now, so therefore, you could deduce from this that the story, the mitzvah of telling the story, has to be done on the night of the 15th, because it has to be done in conjunction with the objects of the mitzvah, and the time for that is the night of the 15th. Just let's ask a simplistic type of question. Superficial question. And that is, if you're telling me that when I tell the story, it can't be done purely in the abstract, but it has to include these ideas. The idea that it's because of this. That's why that's a very significant aspect of the miracle, of the Exodus. Why were we taken out of Egypt? For what purpose? Which is a very important idea. It's the kind of idea that nobody thinks about. People are extremely superficial when it comes to Pesach. Pesach is a very popular kind of a holiday. And even in non-religious Jews, probably the most popular day on the Jewish calendar. Yom Kippur is also very popular, but for a different reason. Everybody wants an atonement. But Pesach is popular, but it's, I guess of all the holidays, it has this, these elements that people are attracted to, the Seder, getting together and singing songs, drinking some wine. That's what they're attracted to. What the Haggadah itself describes, for example, as these great rabbis that gathered together in Bnei Brak and got so involved in learning until they totally forgot about the performance of mitzvahs. That's not something which the average person relates to. Indeed, it's a very high level. It's difficult even for us, for people that are involved in learning. We can relate to it, we can appreciate it. We can understand that even if we're not on the level to actually perform it, we recognize the ideal that's contained therein. However, most people, in my opinion, have the idea that what's great about Pesach, why it's attractive, is because cheres, it's freedom. That's what they're attracted to. That the Jews were enslaved, and slavery is evil, and you see from this that Judaism, of course, is opposed to enslavement, and freedom is a wonderful thing. That's something that resonates with people, especially in America today, in our culture, where the greatness of America is that the land of the free. Everybody likes that idea, and now that there's a war against Iraq, that's a big theme. to free. That's the name of the war. Freedom for Iraq.
Iraq freedom.
The question that I'm asking is, that's the general assumption. And that's what they've come to celebrate. And that's why it's very attractive. Are they correct in that assumption? That is really indeed what the night of Pesach is all about. This type of question is advice to people who are conducting the Seder. With people, many people will be at the Seder that are not especially religious or observant or learned. And they're attracted to the Seder, but they don't want to get too bogged down in the learning aspect of it. They want to get into the singing aspect of it, the food, and some discussions, okay, and then the friendship of the evening. But not getting into the story of too much into the story. My advice is to challenge them with questions that hit them on their level. And I think this is a question that hits them on their level. Most people would give some kind of an answer. And when they give an answer, you shouldn't just drop the answer, you should challenge the answer. And that does two things. It evokes further discussion, and it also may have an impact upon them emotionally. They may feel a little bit challenged. They get them defensive, and they start arguing back. They get into an argumentative mode. That's fine, as long as it doesn't get... We're not looking for a crazy argument. What you're looking for is people in a psychological state in which they want to contend on the intellectual level. That's really the goal of someone who is conducting a Seder. And indeed, we do have a responsibility, as we'll soon see, as we get more into the mitzvah of telling over the story, that we do have an obligation. It starts out with bincha. You shall teach it to your son. You may have noticed that the Rambam, in trying to affix the time at which the mitzvah takes place, in a very subtle way, he's shifted psukim. Nobody brought that to my attention. Nobody challenged me on that. The Rambam starts off by saying it's a mitzvah. And how do I know it's a mitzvah? He cites the pasuk. And what's the pasuk that he cites? Zachar, remember. And remember over here isn't the same type of remembering as we find by the Shabbos, which is to declare. Declaration, enunciation. Then he goes to the next issue. And that is, how do I know the time? But the source that he quotes is not Zachar. The source that he quotes is a different pasuk, Vigar Talincha. You shall tell it to your child. But what is that? But the mitzvah is really Zachar. So you could ask me a halachic question in terms of the Rambam's formulation. That is to say, that the source that he derives it from is from Vigar Talincha. You shall teach it to your child, and that mitzvah is at that time when the matzah and mora are in front of you. Oh, that's very nice, but I thought we were dealing with the mitzvah of Zachar. Let's just get one issue out of the way before we proceed. You may also ask that if the point is that when you tell the story, it's sort of a show and tell kind of thing, that you have to have the physical objects present. So if that's the case, why must that be on the night of the 15th? You can get matzah. You can bake matzah anytime you want. So why couldn't a person say on the 10th of the month or the 1st of the month or whenever take some matzah, take some maror, take some meat for the Korban Pesach? Well, that would be a harder one to explain. How do you have a Korban Pesach? Well, today we don't have the Korban Pesach. Today we just have something to remind us of it. Actually, we eat the Afikoman in the place of the Korban Pesach, the Passover sacrifice. The answer, however, is that when it says, Bavur Zeh, when you point to these objects, matzah and maror, and the Passover sacrifice, the lamb, and the time when it's applicable, we're not talking about the physical object. We're talking about the object of mitzvah, which does not come into being. Matzah doesn't exist during the year. Matzah only exists on Pesach, because matzah is not just the physical object that people call matzah. Matzah as an object of mitzvah comes into being only at that time when it is an object of mitzvah. And when is it an object of mitzvah? On the night of the 15th. Matzah during the year is bread, unleavened bread. People will use the term matzah as a descriptive phenomenon, but it doesn't have any halachic significance. It means when the halachic entity of matzah comes into existence, it only comes into existence at that point in time. Thus we've learned that the telling of the story is something which has to be done in conjunction with the very objects which constitute the mitzvah, upon which one is going to perform the mitzvah. The next question that arises is, what is the connection between Zachor, remember, which the Rambam began with, and V'higadot l'vincha, you shall tell it to your son. The Rambam is trying to make a deduction as to the timing of the mitzvah of Zachor, remember, from the timing of the mitzvah of V'higadot l'vincha. You shall tell it to your son. Well, what's the connection between the two? The answer is that the basic mitzvah, on its most fundamental level, is merely to tell the story. To tell about the great miracles of the story that took place on that night. However, there are different levels. There are different aspects that become part of the mitzvah. Thus, if a person doesn't have a child, so then, obviously, he's not involved. He can be involved in this aspect of the mitzvah. But there is an aspect of telling the story in a manner which fulfills a certain objective, levincha, to teach your children. Thus, it's not just a question of telling the story. It's true it's telling the story. But the story, what is the objective of telling that story? What's the kiyum, so to speak? What's the fulfillment? What's it supposed to bring about? It's really explained in the pasuk. The aspect of you shall tell it to your children is to really transmit the system of mitzvos from one generation to the next. That's the ultimate objective of the sipur, of the story, because this story is the foundation of the system. The system of Yahadus, the system of mitzvos. You see, that's incorporated. The very pasuk which tells you that your obligation cannot be fulfilled completely just by yourself. And if you have a child, you're obligated to fulfill it in conjunction with the child, is related to the factor of Ba'avur Zeh. Because what do you tell the child? You tell him the story, but you also, when you tell the child, you have to tell him why. What purpose? Is it just to be free? Just to be out of Egypt? No. It's to be involved in a unique type of a system, which God has revealed to us. The system of mitzvos. The Jewish religion. I don't like to use the word religion, but the entire life, the life of Torah and mitzvos. The revelation. The way of life that God revealed to us to achieve the objective that we were created for. This is the night. But it all has its roots, the whole foundation. What creates the whole obligation upon us is because of the Exodus. This goes back now to the question that I raised before. The freedom factor. People are attracted to the Seder because they like the idea of freedom and they believe that this is what took place. The people were enslaved and God made them free. Is that the correct notion? The idea that that is what we're celebrating. The removal of tyranny. Pretty much in line with what people in general would attribute to what the United States is doing in Iraq. Is that the same thing? That's another way of phrasing this question. That's how most Americans view it. I'm not getting into the politics of it. Let's just take it at face value. These are an enslaved people, and that's evil, and they deserve to have a chance at freedom. So once the regime is destroyed, they will emerge and have a new system, free way of life. And that's pretty much the same as what took place to us a few thousand years ago, and that's why we can identify with it. That is what the average individual would think, is that correct? The answer is that that freedom is not true freedom. It looks like freedom. It just means the absence of external restraints. I'm not going to minimize this. And practically speaking, of course, whenever you see in the world the situation of oppression and enslavement, that's evil. And if a person can do something about it, of course, that should be done. But when a person was enslaved and is removed, if a person was in a jail and is taken out of jail, doesn't necessarily mean that the person is free in the true philosophical sense. It's evil for a person to be enslaved because it makes it virtually impossible for them to achieve the objective of their existence. But that's what makes slavery evil. What's evil is that a human being should exist. It was designed to achieve a certain type of a purpose. That's what evil is, deflection from the purpose of one's existence. But let's say a person is not going to be involved in the real purpose of their existence. Let me give you a very stark example. Take a person who's imprisoned and all their freedom is taken away from them. Or a person living in a society where you don't have any kind of rights and so on and so forth. You're at the whims of somebody else. And if that person were to be removed, this person would be living purely according to their emotions, their instincts, just following all of their drives. They would be living a non-intellectual kind of an existence, as is the case with regard to most of the world. People follow their dreams, their pursuits, their emotions. That's the kind of life they'd be living. Would you say that there's something worthwhile for a people such as that to achieve their freedom? Let's say a person is in jail. So of course the person feels bad, they don't have the freedom to do whatever they want to do. But let's say that the system in which they're in is not too oppressive. It's more like an army where they have responsibilities and they have to conform to a certain discipline and they have to engage in certain constructive activities and they just can't follow their natural way. Then the person is removed from that and gets totally involved in material pursuits, may make some money and gets involved in drugs, and lives a purely hedonistic, animalistic existence. Now, upon reflection, looking back, when was the person better off? Let's say, I'll add another factor to sort of sweeten the pot, so to speak. Let's say included when the person was in jail, since that person had very little opportunity to indulge the natural curiosities and imagination. There was no television, there was no movies, games and bars in which one could drink and that type of thing. Had to live according to rigorous discipline and couldn't eat whatever the person wanted to eat, so he was healthier, he was more fit physically. But the only thing that the person could do in his spare time was to go to the library, and the library only had books of a purely intellectual character. Books about science, books about physics, books about ideas, books about philosophy. Those are the only kinds of books because they weren't nice. They didn't want to pamper the soldiers. So they looked at all these intellectual books that most people would disdain. That's not what I'm interested in. Now we want to have videos. We want to have novels. There were no novels, except if they were deemed to be of very high quality, which would require thought. So all the things that the person could get access to were things that really required thought, deep thought and analysis. And this person had no choice. It's such a hard life. And this is what they called leisure activities. He was able to go to the library a few hours a day. So at first he was very disappointed. But then, having no choice, he began to read it and delve into it. And he couldn't understand it, so he'd ask questions and then they would have discussions, and he would start thinking about it and get involved for hours at a time, get involved, and suddenly he discovered that this is an unbelievable joy of discovering new ideas and learning. So while the person was in jail, the person was living an existence which it did have a lot of elements of restriction to it, but a certain part of that person had obtained the new freedom, was functioning, was alive. Then the person was released from jail, and even though he had derived a lot of enjoyment from the intellectual activities he was involved in jail, but somehow or other he didn't make the click. The desire, the fantasies that he harbored within him was so powerful that he abandoned that whole lifestyle and went on a chase for his fantasies and got completely out of the habit of the enjoyment of the intellectual, and he got bogged down in a life which was involved in unending materialism and hedonism and taking drugs and alcoholism, and miserable. Miserable. He's free, but miserable. He was unfree, but happy. Looking back, when was that person better off? I think this illustration explains what we're talking about, gives the answer. There's an imaginary freedom, the fantasy of freedom, which people harbor within them and talk about. It's pretty similar to the fantasy of wealth. People live according to their imagination. They have very powerful imagination. That is, that if they only were free, free means from the burden of existence. Why do people even have fantasies? People that are free, that live in America, they still have fantasies. Because they don't envision themselves as being completely free. Now, if I was only wealthy, then they think they'd be free. It's a fantasy. There's the fantasy of freedom. That is not what Pesach is about. Pesach is about true human freedom, which can only come into being when a person recognizes the real essence of their nature, which is the divine soul. As long as the person is living their life according to the element which enslaves them, which is the instinctual, that thwarts the soul from achieving its true objective, its true purpose. The true good of human existence is when mankind is in a state where it achieves the real purpose of existence. And just because a person doesn't have external restraints does not mean that he's in a state of freedom. Because that's because of the factor of choice. You have to understand the complicated nature of a human being. A human being has two elements within him. One element is the soul, which gives him the capacity for freedom. The other element is the instinctual, which creates the danger of enslavement. That's the real source of slavery. Because as I've shown you, it's possible for a person to be in a situation of external servitude, slavery. And depending on the degree, a person can be living in a dictatorship. It's true, it's a terrible thing, but even so, or even in jail, a person just has access to some books and learning and teaching. Even within jail, the person will have much, much greater freedom than everybody on the outside. A person can live in a dictatorship with a lot of the freedoms restricted, but let's say they don't bother you, they let you learn. They let you learn Torah, and all right, so you have a meager existence, you're not wealthy. But because of that, all of your energy is now going to be directed towards the joys of the soul that they can't take away from you. Let's say they can, obviously, they can torture you. I'm talking to the extent where they don't torture you and make it impossible for you to conduct the activity. But a state which most people would regard as being a dictatorship or a lacking of freedom, because I can't just do whatever I feel like doing. That state where a person was engaged in the true human activity, that person would be free. And people on the outside who are simply under the complete domination of the instinctual, which is the enslaving part of man, they'd be slaves. So the idea that people have of what constitutes freedom and what the Seder is all about is absolutely false, because a person cannot know what the idea of freedom is unless a person has a recognition of the true good for Adam, for man. That's the Higad to Levincha. The real objective of the Sefer is to teach your child the Exodus, of course, what the whole objective was. That's the theme of Cheiros. The theme of the evening is Cheiros, the real freedom. Ba'verzeh, in conjunction with Zeh. This can only come about when a person latches on to the system which God gave us. That's Baruch HaMakom Baruch Ho. That's the whole idea. When you're dealing with the four sons, you're getting into that aspect of Higad to Levincha. This aspect of the Seder, to teach it to your children. And what are you teaching to your children? The story of the Exodus. But the story of the Exodus is only in conjunction with the establishment of true cheiros, of true freedom. And that comes about only through HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Only through man's recognition of God, and man's recognition and acceptance of the system that he gave us, Baruch Shanatan Torah. the giving of the Torah. It's through the Torah, which contains two very powerful factors, the Torah per se, and the mitzvahs, the system of mitzvahs. Because it's not just in the abstract, it directs a person in terms of certain activities. Every activity of mitzvah deals with a certain emotion of the individual and helps him to transform himself into a being that operates from the emotional framework. And even within the emotional framework, he gratifies himself through a mechanism which depends upon the exercise of the intellectual control over the emotions.